When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Yo, what is going down, everybody? Welcome to Show Me the Meaning, Wisecracks Movie Podcast.
Show me the meaning, man!
Main?
Let's do it! Hustle and flow!
What up? I'm Austin Hayden. I'm joined by the Show Me the Meaning crew. We've got Ryan.
What up, film fans?
And we've got Raymond.
Hey, everybody. How's it going?
And this week, we're going to be talking about the 2005 music drama... when you look at it, when you Google it, it says romance drama. I'm not sure that's how I would describe this film, but you know,
no.
I would disagree. I think there are some great romantic moments. We'll get into it.
Think this should be on the romance shelf at Blockbuster?
I don't think it should be on the romance shelf, but Austin was saying he was making it sound like no, there's no romance in this whatsoever.
No, there's some romance.
And for you Gen Zers out there, Blockbuster was a place we used to have to go to rent VHS tapes. And if you don't know what a VHS tape is, well, maybe one day these old fuckers will tell you about it. But we're talking about Hustle and Flow, written and directed by Craig Brewer, produced by John Singleton, starring Terrence Howard, Taraji P. Henson, Anthony Anderson, Taryn Manning, DJ Qualls, and Luda has an appearance, as well as many others. I think the performances are fantastic.
Isaac Hayes, baby.
Isaac Hayes is in there, damn straight. As always, what we'll do is we'll go around and give our first impressions. What was it like the first time we saw this film? What's it been like revisiting it? And then, of course, the most recent time. Let's start with Memphis's own Ryan Haley, Red State Ryan. Also, this was your suggestion, was it not, to watch this film? So
I did put it down there. Yeah.
Okay. So I'm assuming that you chose this partly because it's in your blood. Memphis is in your blood. Is this correct?
Yeah, this is definitely a personal choice for me. This is a big time movie for me personally. It kind of came out at the perfect time because I was just going to film school and whatnot, and then this guy comes out of nowhere and makes a big Memphis movie, and it's a Hollywood success. It won at Sundance and stuff. So it was like very inspiring in a way, you know, that someone made a cool movie from Memphis. I think that this works on a just pop culture film level, you know, very accessible popcorn movie. And then it also, I think, is a very complex, dramatic piece of filmmaking that's super cinematic and has, you know, and it's also very much takes the vibe of Memphis and synthesizes it into a movie, which I think is hard to do. And yeah, I think it works. It's cool. I think it still holds up. So, you know, I think maybe I say holds up. I think that if a lot of people watch this now, it maybe doesn't hold up in some ways. It's a little cheesy, you know, if you're going to be totally honest sometimes, but I think that it transcends that in a way and makes and really takes these characters that could become archetypes in a different film and makes them pretty complex and fun to watch their development. And I love movies that show like music being created, which I don't think that there's enough movies like that, like singing people write a song in a film and have it happen. There's only a couple. I don't know, like that movie Once, that Irish movie.
Fucking
I think that
one of my favorites
is a good example. Yeah, you know, this is kind of belongs in that subgenre of musicians trying to make it, but then it also has this very specific Memphis flavor to it. And I got to meet Craig Brewer once, like right before this movie even came out, just because, you know, Memphis is a small town, so it was like a friend of a friend of a friend whose mom knew my mom and whatever, and we like went and had a beer at the Poor Hungry Cafe, and he was so nice to me and just like literally talked to me for like 2 hours. It was like, oh, this year's gonna go, you know, try and be a filmmaker and stuff. And I was just quiet, like, you know, but he like you wouldn't he was so nice to me. But yeah, you would not expect this movie to come out of him, and just from the little time I had with him.
So he's,
you
know, from, like, he's from Memphis then.
He a big part of his life, he grew up in Memphis. I think that basically at the beginning, I think his biography is that he was like born in Memphis and then at some point moved to Orange County. Another bizarre connection. My second cousin Dave Fitzpatrick, I don't know why I'm saying his name, but he was his teacher in high school. So that's another weird connection.
Fucking
so
weird.
I think that Memphis just had a big, profound, you know, effect on his life, and then he kind of wanted to come and make a movie celebrating Memphis. And I don't know, I think he did it pretty successfully.
Sick. Okay, so I don't want to go off track at all, but I just have to say, Once was fantastic, but if you haven't seen the follow-up, and this is definitely for the audience, Sing Street is one of my favorite movies of the last, like, 10 years. So
that's a good one,
fucking
too,
Sing Street. Same director, John Carney. So anyway, okay, Raymond, what was it like the first time you saw this film, and how about on repeated viewings, and does the film hold up?
Yeah, I saw this one in high school, and I hadn't seen it since. I had only watched it the once. I'm a huge fan of Black Snake Moan.
Okay.
And I really, really like Craig Brewer, just because my affinity for that film. And I'm quite partial to Dolomite Is My Name. I also think he did a pretty good job with the Footloose remake. But Hustle and Flow, I hadn't watched it since high school. And my memory of it was like, oh yeah, I enjoyed that movie well enough. But my memory of it was like, oh, but that seems like kind of a stepping stone movie. And he really came into his own on Black Snake Moan. So Ryan, I have to thank you, man, because this rewatch was a delight. I was so glad to have a reason to check this out again and move it to the top of my watch list. I'm really eager to hear more of your perspective on this, because there's a there's this old book from Taschen called Cinema Now. Taschen does all these great books, like movies of the 70s, the 80s, the 90s, etc. And they did one on independent auteurs back in the mid-aughts. And they did a segment on Craig Brewer in that, which was right after Black Snake Moan had come out. And in his sort of blurb in that, since they had interviewed him, he said something about how he really likes being thought of as a regional filmmaker, and he's glad that people associate him with Memphis. And one of the things I'm most eager to talk about is how well he utilizes this setting and makes a character out of the environment. It really is it lends a great air of authenticity and verisimilitude to the story that you don't get from your typical LA or New York based movies. You could very easily see a version of this that takes place on the coasts, but it just wouldn't be the same. It wouldn't have the same life. I loved it. I'm really excited to talk about it.
Cool. So I had never seen it before. This was my first time watching it, and it was really interesting because so the film comes up, and you know, it's like in association with MTV Films or whatever, and I was kind of like, oh, is this going to be like one of those like you know, like the dance films that MTV or the other music films that MTV Films were really
Step Up.
Yeah, like those kinds of things, and I was like, is this going to be like a really sort of aspirational kind of cheesy Disneyfied sort of version, but with a little bit of like the music edge that MTV was doing, like the TRL edge. That's what I was wondering, right? Like, is this gonna, but then I was like, no, because I don't think Ryan would suggest a film like that, because usually you like things with a little grit in them. So I kind of was like, okay, so I was curious, and then I remembered all of the awards buzz that surrounded this film as well. And usually awards buzz doesn't follow unless there's some sort of like seriousness, or it's like a prestige piece in some way, right? Or like if it's saying something. So I was like, okay, cool. So then I watched it, and yeah, I fucking love the film. It moves, the pacing is great. I love watching them make the song in the studio. You know, I grew up I was in a band for like almost 8 years, and us in the studio, you know, was like one of my favorite things in the entire world. And so I just love seeing them in the makeshift studio. Like, our first studio experience growing up was in my our bass player, and then the manager of our band was his dad, and it was in like the living room, right? And so like that was where we recorded music and shit before we ever got into a studio. And so I love that stuff of seeing people come together. I also actually really enjoyed the aspirational elements. Yeah, of course, there's a little bit of a nice gloss painted over a certain part of life in those conditions, but I think it's because the film is more like a myth, I think, than anything. But it's a myth that also has like this interesting, maybe I could even say sociological lens that opens up onto the South, blues music's connection to hip hop, the genre of storytelling from the perspective of the pimp. And I felt like there was something there. I was like, there's stuff that I'm not getting, right? I'm not from this area. There's something culturally that kind of like distinguishes me or that separates me from this. I was like, I don't know. So I reached out to Dr. Kamasi Hill, who those of you would know if you listened to our Summer of Soul video, who is a scholar of African American history, who has also made a documentary on hip hop music. And so I was like, do you got a take on this? And he sent me a really nice long take on this film that kind of confirmed some of my senses about the relationship to blues and hip-hop music in the South and stuff like that. And I'll read it on the other side of the synopsis and stuff like that, because I think there's a lot of interesting stuff there that we can talk about as well. But there's a lot of there's so much here that is like a sort of lens, like an aperture opened up on a certain kind of culture that I thought was like really interesting, and that there's a lot there that we can peel back on. So anyway, I fucking loved it. I thought it was really interesting. And I also think it'd be interesting, we should probably talk about it too, because I read a few reviews, because I didn't know anything about this film. I read a few reviews that were kind of like, look, there's some interesting stuff about this, but there's a lot of misogyny as well in it. So obviously there's some themes in here that we could say like, oh, is there something problematic in certain types of rap music and hip hop music that are misogynistic, that do degrade women, et cetera, et cetera. That's stuff that we can talk about. Is this film kind of falling into that trap? Or does this film kind of have some sort of ethic that it's basically saying like, look, this is the life that you're living when you're stuck in certain scenarios and you try to make the best of it, and doesn't mean you're doing good things, or that we should kind of like castigate you and judge you and throw you into the dustbin. This is just a difficult, it's hard out here for a pimp, I guess is essentially what I'm saying.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and we would be remiss.
And it's hard out here for a sex worker. Actually, my girl turned to me at one point and she's like, it is hard out there for a pimp. She's like, but what about it's hard out there for a sex worker? And I was like, yeah, yeah, right.
That'd be a good follow up. But yeah, that was also the other biggest gift of this film, and I'll never forget it, is that Oscars, when fucking 3-6 Mafia, my Memphis homeboys fucking take home the gold, and then Jon Stewart has that awesome fucking moment where, because he was hosting, he's like, for everyone keeping score at home, Martin Scorsese 0, 3-6 Mafia 1. And we all just were like, yeah!
Well, I remember him coming out too and saying like, folks, that is how you accept an Oscar.
Oh yeah, it was fucking awesome. Great, they were like so amped. They were so excited. It was great. Classic Memphis moment. And
that's fucking amazing. Okay, cool. So let's do a brief recap for people who either haven't seen the film or it's been a long time since you've seen it. So DJ is a philosophizing pimp and small-time drug dealer in Memphis, Tennessee. The film opens with a soliloquy of him about how humans are not dogs, even if men can sometimes act as dogs, right before he offers up his number one sex worker, Nola, for cheap to a John. DJ is basically dissatisfied with his lot in life. He lost his father at a young age and has always had dreams of being a rapper. One day, by chance, he runs into his high school friend Key, who is a music producer, producing small-town church gatherings and court depositions and things of that nature. DJ ends up selling Key on the idea that they should make music together. At first, Key isn't quite sold, but once he hears DJ's beats and bars, he decides to team up, much to the chagrin of his wife. Now, through the course of producing their music, they ran into some technical difficulties and setbacks, as well as difficulty finding a hook to make their music radio-friendly. So they enlist the help of one of DJ's girls, the pregnant Suge, who lays down the hooks and turns their rough flows into catchy tunes. DJ then wants to get his demo into the hands of local legend Skinny Black, hoping that Skinny will be able to get the music into the right hands and send him on his way to success. But after a night of boozing and smoking with Skinny, DJ finds out that Skinny actually threw the demo into the toilet. So DJ freaks out and beats the shit out of Skinny, shoots one of Skinny's men, and then gets arrested and sentenced to a year in prison. However, while in prison, Nola, his number one girl and number one investor, as he refers to her, takes over the operation and runs the music business for DJ, ultimately hustling to get the song, to get the radio play that they all sought after. And then the film...
I'm in charge!
And the film closes with a couple of prison guards coming up to DJ, asking him if he'll check out their demo while he walks away smiling with pride. End of movie. All right, but before we continue, we gotta give a shout out to our sponsor of this week's episode, Storyblocks. Storyblocks is the complete stock solution, providing an unlimited library of over a million plus. That's right, a million plus royalty-free, high-quality video, audio, and images through cost-effective subscription plans. They have an ever-growing library of assets, including 4K and HD footage, After Effects and Premiere Pro templates, music, images, SFX, more. And did... royalty friggin' free. We use the goodies here at Wisecrack. I use them personally. My friends use them personally. Don't rely on ripping YouTube videos or paying for things that you don't need to pay for, because you can get access to an unlimited, ever-expanding library. Go to storyblocks.com/wisecrack or click a link in the show notes. That is storyblocks.com/wisecrack to learn more about Storyblocks. Now let's get back to the show. All right, so let me do this. Let me read Dr. Kamasi Hill's little message that he sent me. I said, basically, because he saw that we were doing this, and he was like, bro, and I was like, yeah, I know. I was like, if you've got a take, or if you've got anything hot insight that you can give us, let me know. He said this. This is his take. He says, while hip-hop is a genre that has its origins in Jamaica and the East Coast, Southern hip-hop is inherently connected to the blues tradition that is a part of the Memphis tradition and sound. The pimp-slash-criminal in the 1970s were always one of the best storytellers because the street life offered some of the most authentic crime tales. It's one of the reasons pimp literature, for example, from Black Pulp Publishing, were some of the most successful selling genres. Iceberg Slim and Donald Goines were very popular. Now, while the pimp life is criminal and profoundly secular, DJ's most important experiences in the film had religious connotations. His tears in church at the beginning before he meets Key, Suge's dream visions and discovery of her talent, and the references to the importance of dreams. So this was Kamasi's take. There's a lot there, the interesting stuff about the Memphis tradition. I had never heard of pimp literature. So Black Pulp Publishing, for those of you out there that are familiar with that, and I guess it was a very successful genre, completely something that is outside of my wheelhouse. And then, of course, the kind of intrinsic connection between Southern hip-hop that's inherently connected to the blues tradition, which we get in... Oh, shit, I forgot. What's DJ Qualls? What's his character's name?
I forget, too.
The white guy.
Shelby.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, no, I'm sorry. He's not white. He's just light-skinned.
Shelby County is where this takes place, by the way. I don't know if that's
funny. Okay, so and there's that bit where they're high and they're smoking, and that's one of the things that Shelby says. He's like, look, music, hip-hop music, this music is coming back to the South, and it's always been about connected to the blues, which has always been about women and about pain and about struggle, right? And so this film is kind of dealing with those elements. There's something going on there. It's about finding your power in a situation that is less than desirable. And so it starts off with this guy who is a criminal, a small-time criminal, because his father died when he was young. He was forced into this situation, but he doesn't love it. He doesn't want it. And then there's also that really, there's these really powerful scenes with Nola as well, where she's like, I want to do something. I don't fucking know what, because I don't even have the resources to be able to think about what my options might be, but I fucking want to do something, right? So she felt like she was meant for something more. So there's this aspirational idea that you could call kind of religious, this transcendent desire for more, for utopia, for the American dream, some kind of dream, something like that. And I thought that there's a lot of interesting stuff there. What do you guys think? You resonate with any of those themes?
Oh, absolutely. I think there's some really... interesting stuff surrounding those ideas in the film. You bring up that Taryn Manning scene, which I think she's wonderful in. What's funny is that Craig Brewer said on the commentary that everyone kind of latched on to the everybody's got to have a dream thing that sort of cuts through from his conversation with Ludacris and then is the final line of the movie, ended up becoming the tagline on a lot of the posters and stuff. And what's funny is on the commentary, Craig Brewer said that he had written that line from this kind of place of cynicism, that he and his dad always had this joke that like anytime someone would tell them about their fantasy or their dream of like, oh, you know, one day I'm going to be a musician or one day I'm going to own a business or one day I'm going to blah, blah, blah. He and his dad would always turn to each other and go, well, everybody's gonna have a dream. And it was just kind of their way of being really like condescending and sort of snarky, and their sort of inside joke that like, yeah, you say that, but you're just gonna keep sinking into your couch at the end of every day and do nothing with your life. And he said that when he was writing that, it sort of just naturally came out of the character Skinny Black, because to him, he's like, oh, he is being condescending. But there's something about about DJ throughout the film, who is, you know, let's get it out of the way, he's not the best person, but he is a very compellingly earnest character that when he hears that from Ludacris in his head, it's like, oh, okay, he gets it. We come from the same place. And then, you know, it's kind of, I think, up to the viewer how to interpret Terrence Howard's final line in the movie, that when he repeats it to the prison guards, because it's like, fuck, you've got a demo tape and you're a prison guard? Like, Jesus Christ, yeah. These demo tapes just fall from heaven, apparently. Every single person has one of these. Even in prison, folks will hand you a demo tape. And you're like, where am I going to listen to this? And they're like, oh, in the rec room. And it is one of those things where you think, like, now that he has maybe just kind of gotten a little bit to the other side, and he's looking back, like Skinny Black says, you know, Memphis is in the rearview mirror a little bit. Even if he's in prison, he's now a high status character. So there is this question of, like, does he really think that, like, oh, am I going to give these guys the benefit of the doubt and give this a listen when I get the chance? Or does he now have that sort of, like, big man complex that, you know, he's saying it with some cynicism all of a sudden, because it's like, okay, but I hustled for this. You're just a fucking prison guard. What the hell do you know? Like, what kind of music is a fucking prison guard going to make?
I do like how the morality of this film is pretty messy. And I mean, that's a benefit of it, not like a detractor. And yeah, like you brought up misogynism and stuff. It's like, of course, he's a pimp, you know, like that comes with the job. But like, I like that this movie's about a pimp going through, like, essentially an existential crisis, you know, or a midlife crisis or whatever. So it is about him confronting who he is, the choices he's made, what he's doing with his life. And, you know, everybody in this movie is flawed in a pretty big way, I would say. But then by the end, I do think that, you know, he crosses over and does have, you know, a heart, but also, like you're saying, with in terms of what the American dream aspect, and how I think he has this genuine ambition and one need to change. But then I do think that the movie is very messy in how it deals with how he got his success. He essentially wouldn't, you know, yeah, his mixtapes are cool and Whoop That Trick's awesome or whatever, but like the way he gets big is because now he has this legend and this rep of having beat the shit out of Skinny Black. Is that how the movie telling us, oh, you got to go beat the shit out of the most famous person in your hometown to get some respect? You know, I mean, he got where he wanted to go, but in the weirdest way, direction possible, and it probably, you shouldn't replicate it. But I do think that that's part of the cynical nature of the movie. It's like, and also it's like I like how this movie deals with just art and stuff, because and creating it, because they're trying to sell out from the beginning. They're like, we need to actively go and make a marketable
radio play.
Yeah, we have to get radio play. This is like, this is about us making money off of this music and getting out of our shitty situation. And also, yes, obviously, you know, he's putting his heart and soul into it, but like that's the object, right? Which is different than, oh, I'm just going to make my art and fuck the box office potential of it. No, that's not what these people are doing. And I think that that's an interesting, it's just a cool set of circumstances to explore.
It's also one of those great, like, Twilight Zone endings where it's like, okay, you achieved your dream, but at what price? You know, there's that great Twilight Zone episode where the guy becomes immortal, and then because he's so bored and inured to the natural experiences of life, he just goes out and starts, like, committing crimes and trying to kill himself, and he eventually gets imprisoned for a life sentence, and that's, you know, sort of the downbeat of it at the end. But there is this this great story that they talk about in all the behind the scenes stuff, where on the day that they, what's the name of, it's not Taraji P. Henson, but, or Taryn Manning, the other, woman, that the other sex worker that lives with him, Lexis. I can't remember the name of the actor. But the scene where he kicks her and her son
Robert,
out of the
Robert?
House,
is that the baby's name?
I'm not sure. They said in the behind the scenes stuff that when they were doing that scene, they had to, like, just completely halt production for a few hours because they were like, we don't know how to do this in a way that won't completely make the audience turn on DJ. And we also don't know, she's such a, like, a strong presence, we don't know how to get her out without some kind of, like, physical altercation, but we don't want the audience to turn on him. And so they're turning this over in their head, and I think it was their producer, Stephanie Allen, who stepped in, and she was like, hey, Craig, there's no good way to kick a woman and her child out of your home. Like, people are gonna, like, turn on him a little bit here. You might lose some of the audience's favor, but that's what's true to the character, and you have to do what's true to the character. And then they shot it as they did, which is like, he kind of pushes her out. There's no like, at least as I recall, I don't think he ever strikes her or anything like that. But it's still one of those things where, like, oh, this is such a fucking ugly thing for him to do, all for the sin of not believing in his, at this point, probably unbelievable dream. And it is one of those things where, like, every time they felt like they were sort of painting themselves into a corner with a potential audience, it did come back to that thing of, like, no, we have to be true to these characters and just trust that the audience will be engrossed in the process of it, and they will be engrossed in this journey, even if this is a flawed main character.
Yeah, I did read a couple reviews. So, like, Mark Kermode and Peter Travers, they kind of were down on, you know, elements of misogyny and stuff like that in their early reviews. But I read some reviews from a couple of feminist film blogs and film reviewers, one called The Happy Feminist and one called Feminist Film Critic. And The Happy Feminist said something that I thought was kind of interesting that I just wanted to read real quick. She wrote, "While I kept waiting for someone to exhibit really bad or awful or violent behavior, all the characters acted like fundamentally decent people who just happened to be stuck at the bottom of the barrel." Now, I thought that was kind of interesting because, like you said, Raymond, earlier, you said, you know, DJ's not a quote-unquote good person, right? And this scene in particular is one that could lose a lot of people watching it, right? Because of the actual physical altercation that does take place. But I wonder, like, I read this and I say, you know, they're all fundamentally decent people. Is that something we can say? Is that maybe why that scene doesn't, like, make the whole film turn sour in our mouths? Is there something, because is he quote-unquote decent? Like, is it because he has these desires for something more, and because he has this past trauma, and because they're in a really high stress situation, do we kind of excuse this altercation? Like, maybe whereas if it were handled under different conditions, we then wouldn't as much, you know?
No, I think it's just, it is, yeah, crazy that your main character does something pretty awful in the middle of your movie. And but yeah, I think that, like Raymond was kind of talking about, I think it's true to the setting and overall, just like, it's not pulling any punches. It's not, it is saying, like, yeah, these people are, you know, you're with them 1 minute, like, just hanging out, oh, we're smoking weed, making a song, and then you're getting into the their worst moments, and the film is showing you both, right? So I think that's just more, yeah, to the filmmaker's credit of not pulling any punches on the setting.
I think there is, I don't necessarily know that decency is the word that I would use, but I do think there is if it's not authenticity to, you know, whatever, there is an adherence to who these characters are established as. And I just think that, you know, it's one of those things that I think a lot of folks just fail to realize with a lot of contemporary films, is that, yeah, sometimes characters are shitty people. Like, the movie's not necessarily, you know, endorsing what it depicts, and I think a lot of people get confused about that sort of thing. And this is, you know, this is a character who does some crummy things, you know, no two bones about it, and that's not the only scene in which he does a terrible or indecent thing. I just think that it's, like I said, people are invested in the humanity of it. There is a reality to this. Like, I mean, I can think of 100 examples of other movies. You know, Scorsese gets taken to task for this from people who like to reduce movies to, you know, their basest kinds of elements. But his movies are always criticized for, oh, I can't believe, you know, he makes main characters or good guys out of all these criminals. And it's like, well, that's not at all what he's doing. There's no point at which anyone turns to the camera and goes, isn't this great? No,
these are cautionary tales.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it is one of those things where I do understand people having a bone to pick with certain problematic aspects of the film, and that they think that, you know, maybe the female characters are underwritten. I could see that argument. I don't necessarily agree with that. I think that they fit into this specific story the way that they fit into these men's lives. And, you know, we talked about this on, I can't remember what episode it was, Austin, but like some movies are predominantly about male characters. And this is something that Craig Brewer even kind of addresses with this movie, that he sat down with each of the actors and he said, look, I think you're a phenomenal actor. And I, you know, it's no disrespect to your character, but this is a movie about women who are standing by their men. And that doesn't mean I'm here to objectify you or to reduce you in any way, but this is a movie that is being driven by a man's dream. And a lot of the characters around him, a lot of the women around him, they either support that dream or he pushes them to the side because that's the kind of person that he is. And I hope you understand that, like, that's the story we're trying to tell. So, yeah, I don't think we need to, like, get out the scales of justice and say, like, well, how can we figure out a way to make this balance and justify all of DJ's actions? Some of the stuff he does is indecent and unjustifiable, but it's ultimately compelling. You know, fucking Breaking Bad is the most popular show of all time. It's about a terrible, terrible person, you know, and everyone, the character everyone hates from Breaking Bad is the wife, because she's the one who's always trying to stop the show from happening.
she's
like the good, like reasonable person in the show. But sorry,
and
I digress.
I was just going to say, at least for that one moment we're talking about, I mean, they do set up her character to be kind of like, she's not the best person either, right? Like she's the kind of the one that's, they're butting the heads.
She's the thorn in his side.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So, he's trying to do something, and she, and they set that up a bit too, because she's got the kid, and he's like, why do you always, you know, got to disrupt him when he's settled? You know, you're gonna give that kid a twitch. So they're set up from the beginning that they have the tense relationship, right? That their relationship is tense. That they butt heads with each other. So, and then it kind of just comes to the boiling point there. Yeah, I wonder. You're talking about Scorsese and like Wolf of Wall Street, and so many people, you know, they kind of get that film wrong because I think it's like a glamorization of Jordan Belfort's like lavish life and living outside the margins of legality and stuff like that. Whereas I see Scorsese, and then, you know, like we talk about Goodfellas, Casino, etc. I look at Scorsese as being like one of the most potent moralists that we have.
I was about to say the
cinema.
Most moralistic filmmakers, who's every movie is dripping with Catholic guilt.
I was just gonna say, and just see Silence if you want to know what he really believes about anything. Like, that's him saying, hey, this is actually what I believe, because he is a good Catholic boy. And this is not a secret, this is not me psychoanalyzing him, this is very explicit. And so when you see him examining these people, he's clearly examining them for satirical purposes or for some sort of like moral, as Ryan just said, a cautionary tale to be like, hey, these people get caught and they get in trouble. And then if they don't get away, if they do get away with it in the end, that's because we live in an unjust world that rewards bad people for doing bad things. But ultimately, I think Scorsese has like, hey, let's not do that though. Like, yeah, we can find something intriguing about crime and, you know, the foundations of America being built on crime. You know, look at Gangs of New York. There's something about the foundations of New York being built on the blood of racism and nativism and these wars and things like that. But again, he's like, hey, but how about we don't do that moving forward, right? And so there's something about him opening up the lens, like literally opening up an aperture onto history, onto these stories that kind of make us who we are, for better or for worse, maybe because we're marred by original sin, to pull out these religious themes that he's probably somehow drawing on, right? And then what we can do then is we can kind of be washed from that somehow, you know, we can transcend above that. And that's where his moralism comes in. I don't think Hustle and Flow has the same type of moral message, at least not explicitly, because it's not like it's saying this lifestyle is dangerous, and this, it's not looking at it from a critical lens as explicitly, even if there is a kind of message that it's trying to say, which I think the message is really like, sometimes you're thrown a shitty hand in life, and people, they have a dream and they want to get out of it and they want to aspire for more. And how can art and creativity be that thing that can allow you to transcend a shitty lot in life? Because it's the scenes of music that brought me to life, you know, like we were bobbing our heads as we're watching it. You know, all of them in the studio are alive. Like when they first lay down, whoop that trick, and they're just going crazy. And then like Taraji
Anthony
Henson,
Anderson's
like that,
so good in that.
It's so good, right? And then Taraji P. Henson, like she comes to life when she puts down that hook, and then she's a part of this, right? Like she has something to give. Like there's something about art and expression that is viewed. Maybe that's the moral message that Brewer and them are exploring here.
Craig Brewer talks a lot about the movies that inspired him to make this. He mentions The Godfather a lot, specifically with that opening monologue, that he really likes his movies to start with this sort of like proclamation of character and, you know, you come to my daughter's wedding or whatever. and he talks about Purple Rain, the music of it. And he talks a lot about Rocky with this movie, that to him, this is his Rocky. You know, this would be a perfect double bill with that.
Yeah.
That this is... And he talks about how like a lot of people who have seen the Rocky sequels forget that Rocky loses the fight in the first movie, and that this is a very, you know, typical Hollywood canard, but people do forget that aspect of it because those movies kind of lost touch with what the first one is about. And to him, this story is, you know, it's not about like, oh, you've got to go out and every person who has a dream is going to be able to achieve it by hook or by crook. It's the Rocky thing, which is like, all that matters isn't that you win. What matters is that you stay on your fucking feet. Like, what matters is that you don't let life just grind you down and destroy you. And you know, to tie it back into some of the stuff we were talking about before, he said that he took a picture of Rocky. There's a picture of Sylvester Stallone with Adrian under his arm from the end of the movie, and that Rocky is kind of like looking off into the stands enjoying this moment, and that Adrian is just looking up at him, and that he showed that to all the cast members, and he was like, this is the movie that we're making. This is the movie that I want to make. And I just want to shout out, before we move on, Julie L. has made some terrific contributions to the chat over here, just to put a button on our previous conversation about female characters in this film. She says, misogyny and colonialism are intrinsically linked. I think that argument can be made that it's one of the reasons why hip-hop lyrics of the time from men rarely reflect feminism, gay, or trans rights. I just thought that was pretty insightful.
Also, Austin, hit the meta button, please. I have a meta point to make. You know, like, I think that this movie has a... I guess you'd call it a dysfunctional family theme going on for it, right?
Mm-hmm.
And
100%.
And I think that kind of really goes into the whole Memphis setting, because Memphis is a pretty dysfunctional place. You know, it's got all this rich history, but it's a very poor place with, you know, heavy violence and stuff. And there is that sense of like, all right, you know, these few people like 3-6 Mafia, Al Capone and stuff have made it out, like, you know, why can't I? And then they're all doing the soundtrack for this movie. So this movie is like has all the skinny blacks from Memphis doing the soundtrack for this movie about an up and coming rap star in Memphis. And I think for people that live in Memphis, you know, I think it's a relatable vibe, and just their whole dysfunctional family. That is Memphis nutshell, you know.
There's a great video of this movie's Memphis premiere where people are just going insane. Oh, yeah. And Craig Brewer, and they're interviewing Craig Brewer on the red carpet, and they're like, what do you think of all this? And he's like, I mean, this is their movie. Like, I made it for this city, and I'm just so honored that they've embraced it like this. And I do think this comes back to, you know, the first thing I said on this episode. I do think that there is so much intrinsic value to having these stories told on such a huge platform by the people who have not just lived them, but lived adjacent to them and can actually bring these voices to life on screen.
Yeah, I was going to say, so what is it that DJ ultimately wants? Because this makes me think, is it money? Is it power? And I think the third one, which is the one that I think it is it's respect and pride, maybe. And it's really, then this kind of ties into it's about being recognized as having had an important purpose and having a place in his community, right? Because they're constantly talking about, and whether or not it's just that he's playing skinny, but he's using the idea that, like, you're from here, but you've abandoned your roots. Like, you're not as in touch with the reality of the material place from which you came, right? And it seems like DJ doesn't really have the respect, you know, the pride of being, like, known as a local representative, a local hero, a local legend, something along those lines. And I also wonder if, you know, the idea of the dysfunctional family also relates to this, because in the end, he kind of starts to have a family, a family maybe where there's a little bit more respect, maybe a little bit more of an equal distribution of roles in power or something like that, with Nola, you know, kind of the one that's in charge now, and then with Suge and him kind of kindling up some sort of romance between them, right? And then obviously she has her child, you know. And I think there's like the maybe hope or the promise that, you know, that they're gonna have a little bit of success with this music career now, and that maybe when he gets out in 11 months that they'll be able to kind of continue this with having turned the corner and a new life is potentially kind of just before them, right? And then that final shot when the guards come up to him and they say, hey, can you check out our demo? And he walks away. I'm thinking to myself, is he going to do like what Skinny does and take that freaking demo tape and throw it into the toilet? Or is he going to listen because now he kind of respects that he's in that position of the elder, that other people look up to him and are like, oh shit, because he has that look of pride on his face, like, oh shit, like they came up to me and they asked me, and these are the guys who are in power, I'm the one who's behind bars, and they're coming to me, so who really has like the power or the social prestige in relation to kind of this whole thing, right, in this power dynamic? And so I kind of wonder, like, what is DJ ultimately seeking? What does he get? Is it about that pride of place, family, community, you know, being a local legend, et cetera, et cetera? What do we think?
I think he basically said it all. I think it's, yeah, he wants to quote unquote be somebody, and now he is. He's got a rep. And but also that comes part and parcel with he doesn't want it to be hard out there for him to be a pimp anymore. He doesn't want to be a pimp. He wants to, he wants it, the easy life. He wants to be like, all right, I think that it is symbolic that he is, you know, a pimp, and that and how he's, I think that DJ, the character, does see him, you know, his occupation is not like this noble thing he's doing. It's what he's doing to get by. You know, he knows that is, like society has deemed being a pimp a disreputable occupation, right? So I think that, yeah, he's at this point in his life where he's like, man, I want to be more than this for the rest of my life. Obviously, I could keep doing this and pay the bills, but this isn't who I'm supposed to be. I'm made for more than this. So
yeah, all I was going to say is that I think you hit it right on the head, that there is, sure, there may be the dream, there may be the fantasy version of where this will take him, but I think there's a big part of him that's just like, I'm just so fucking sick of this being so goddamn hard. Like, if you read the script for this, the language is so beautiful and so evocative, and I can't remember it verbatim, but one of the first lines in the script is that you hear an air conditioner, it says something like panting or something like that, like an air conditioner is chugging or something, and just right away you're like, fuck, the air is heavy in this place. Like, it's just this, you get this sense that everything is just, it is just coming down on him so hard. And yes, we can recognize that, like, in the way that trauma passes from one person to another, like, he is trying to push some of that responsibility or that burden off onto other people and exploiting other people. But it still is one of these things where, like, for all of them, it's this, like, hopeless and inexorable grind. And I think a lot of what motivates him is just, like, I can't fucking do this for another 35 years.
On top of that, like, I love that conversation in the early scenes with him and Taryn Manning where they're in the car together, and then she's like, yeah, remind me what it is the hell that you do. It's like, so, like, you know, at least, you know, she has a, she's doing all the work and stuff. So he is doing less, you know, than her. And so, yeah, he has that moment where he's just like, what the hell did you just say to me? Like, and he knows that she's right. That basically, yeah, what do I do? What is my purpose here? I just basically sit in the car next to you, and then you go, you know, and make $20 in the front, $40 in the behind, you know, like, I think that that's a powerful exchange between him and her to, about how he sees his place in the world.
It reminds me a little bit of something that Cornel West once said, where he said he's a blues man, and he was talking about, I'm a blues man basically because, you know, in the blues it's real, it's material. He's like, that's why we talk about bodies, we don't talk about like life and these kind of more abstract concepts. And there's something that I love what you were just saying, Raymond, about how even the air is heavy. And it's like the past trauma of his father that weighs him down. The air weighs him down. The responsibility, the kind of unfulfilled desires are literally physically weighing him down. And so it's much more material, which really fits into the whole blues hip hop connection as well. That there's something about the materiality, like we got to emphasize that, the materiality of just weighing down on him and on the community, right? And it kind of fits really nicely with that opening monologue where he's talking about how humanity, we're not dogs, right? Like, men aren't dogs, even if men can that's right. And there's something about this view that he has of human nature and of what we're meant to do in life, to try to scrape from out of this materiality, you know? And I've recently watched The White Lotus, at least season one. I know season two, I think, just kind of started airing. And one of the things, I can't remember which episode, I think it's episode 3 or 4, but Steve Zahn's characters talk about how there's the monkey and the man. And he's like, and sometimes the man has to confront the monkey within us. Like, the monkey is instinct and desire and animality and desire to conquer or fight or whatever. But then there's the man, and the man is, you know, has to confront the monkey. And there's always this perpetual battle between kind of the physicality of quote-unquote nature, and then maybe the sort of intellect and the ideas of human consciousness that is always trying to transcend above that. And whether or not we accept that duality, that framework, at least it's an interesting tension there to kind of explore. And I think you get something similar in this film as well.
Absolutely. And I mean, it is humid as fuck in Memphis. So like just every shot of just sweat drenching down all their faces. And when Taryn Manning's complaining about, you know, how sweaty she gets with her customers and stuff, like, it's like, okay, yeah, I believe every second of that. Being, if you're in Memphis for more than 10 minutes, you know exactly what she's talking about.
Craig Brewer was saying that when he was working on his first film, The Poor and the Hungry, he was trying to shoot something at this hotel, and he's walking out with his camera, and his wife is there because she's helping him with the movie, and that this pimp comes up to them, and he's got a girl with him, and he goes, hey, you know, I've got a girl right here, and he's just like, soliciting him so hard, just pressing this woman on him. He's like, $40, take her right back into that hotel you just walked out of. And he's just like, boom, boom, just a machine gun rattling off, this will not stop hustling Craig Brewer. And he was like, fuck, at a certain point I wanted to just give him $40 so he could relax. Just be like, hey man, just fucking relax. And that feels so pervasive to this movie as a whole. Just like, everyone is so like, The only thing that loosens them up is the fucking heat, and that, like, that's half of the battle, you know. It's just it is just this really beautifully evocative setting as character piece, and I think it's a wonderful film. It's ripe for rediscovery if you haven't watched it in a while, folks.
Is this a film? Does it fly under the radar a little bit?
I think so. I think that this doesn't get nearly as much praise as it deserves. I think that this is a classic.
It definitely had its moment, like with the Oscars and everything. It put Terrence Howard on the map in a major way, and then he did everything he could to wipe himself off the map by being a lunatic. I don't think this is talked about very much. I don't think Craig Brewer is talked about very much, because after Black Snake Moan, he used up a lot of his capital trying to get a TV series off the ground. And the only thing that ever got produced for that was the pilot, and I don't know that it ever even aired. So it never got picked up to series, and then he kind of just, like, I don't want to say floated around Hollywood, because that sounds pejorative. I know he was trying to get other stuff made in the interim. But I thought Dolomite Is My Name was a wonderful return to form. I wasn't too crazy about Coming to America, but I'm always happy to see him working. Oh, and I mentioned Footloose before.
Tarzan?
Well, he wrote Tarzan, yeah. I forgot that before Dolomite, he did the Footloose remake, which I think
was that 2011. Yeah.
I don't know, around there. But I think it was a missed opportunity. It's fun in the way that Footloose is just a fun movie, but it just feels like, you know, it feels like a cover of the original rather than doing something new with it. I, for one, think that it was a huge missed opportunity not casting a black actor as Ren, because that would add a whole new dimension to, you know, city kid going to this small town. And a lot of the movie is kind of putting him into, or what he brings to the movie is hip-hop culture in a small urban or a rural environment. So it's like, I don't know how you missed that. It seems like right in front of him. But it's still a fun movie for what it is.
He was totally a director for hire on that one.
Yeah, absolutely. But you still think he would be able to bring some of his own kind of flair to it. But who knows? Maybe he brought that up at some point and the studio nixed it. But I don't know. He speaks pretty well of that experience working on the movie.
Yeah, Ryan, why did you say director's jail after Raymond talked about Black Snake Moan? Were you thinking that did he get shit for that film?
Well, that movie like was he's coming off this huge success and then yeah, he was teed up to basically, all right, what's your next thing, dude? What are you gonna do? And he does this. I mean, I love like Black Snake Moan too, but you know, it's very much a niche passion project that flopped at the end of the day. I think that definitely box office wise, and then I think, yeah, like you said, I hadn't really heard about that TV show that didn't get off the air, but I think that this movie or Black Snake Moan kind of took a lot of his capital, and they were like, all right, he's maybe a one hit wonder. You know, you can only, you basically get one chance, and then, oh, that worked. You get one more chance, you know, and then maybe
it didn't cross over the way that Hustle.
No, not at all. Yeah. And, but it's still a good, good film. But then I do think that probably took a lot of his cachet away, and then he had to kind of remake himself with these more commercial projects, like, oh, I'll take Footloose, I'll write Tarzan or whatever. But then he gets hooked up with Eddie Murphy, and now I think he's back in the saddle again. And I mean, I love Dolomite. I thought that movie fucking rocked.
Funny.
Like, I thought that movie was...
Eddie Murphy. Speaking of Oscar nominations, I don't know where he was. That performance was incredible.
And then also little Easter egg about Hustle, Poor and the Hungry. You probably already know this, Raymond, but yeah, when they're in the back of the strip club at the beginning, you see the main character from Poor and the Hungry.
Yeah.
They're doing selling the t-shirts like she does in Poor and the Hungry, but she's doing it in the back of the strip club. That's just pretty cool. And Poor and the Hungry is a good little, you know, early 2000s digital indie film from Memphis too, by Craig Brewer.
I just want to say one more thing before we move on to the mailbag with regards to him being in director's jail and fighting to get movies made. He worked for 4 years to get this movie off the ground. This was a script that he and his producer believed in wholeheartedly. The producer, Stephanie Allen, took it to John Singleton. Rest in peace, John Singleton. If not for him, this movie would not exist. The man put his house up as collateral so he could personally finance this movie. He came out of pocket, made Craig Brewer's career. All honor, all respect to John Singleton. Still the youngest man to ever be nominated for a Best Director Oscar. Boys in the Hood, legendary. John Singleton, rest in peace.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Amen.
Damn. Okay, well, I guess on that note, we'll go ahead and wrap this up and we'll jump into the mailbag. This is where we're going to kind of tackle some of your thoughts, your questions, your queries, etc., etc. If you want to contribute, you want to leave us a voicemail, you can at 1-213-534-8807. That's 1-213-534-8807. Or alternatively, you can email us movies@wisecrack.co. That's movies@wisecrack.co. We're going to address one voicemail today. I think we got that queued up, so let's listen.
Hey, Show Me the Meaning crew. This is Newman in Chicago calling to respond to your Suicide Squad, the Suicide Squad episode, particularly to my boy Ryan in your shorts. I love you so much, man, but I think you're all messed up on this one. You seem to be comparing a James Gunn movie to a Christopher Nolan movie, when I would argue that he is much closer to a Paul Verhoeven, much more irreverent, much more dark in his humor, taking things just a little less seriously, and above all, admitting from the beginning that the systems of oppression and imperialism have already won, and there's no way to beat them. The best you can do is small victories. Think at the end of RoboCop. Sure, he's regained his humanity, but OCP still runs everything, and he technically still works for them, and that is not going to change. I think that's much closer to the kind of imperialist messaging we're getting in the Suicide Squad. And so I think it's very effective. I think it is baked into the plot, and I think the difficulty is that you're trying to compare it to The Dark Knight when it's really a lot closer to a RoboCop. Those are just my thoughts. I love you guys like crazy. Keep kicking booty and taking names. And Austin, get out and do some more plays, man. What Sam Shepard show are you going to do next?
All right, it cut out a little bit there at the end, but I think we got the majority of the question there. Ryan, what do you think, man?
Well,
the basic gist was this guy wants to fight Ryan.
Well, here's I agree and disagree with him. All right, and I think it's a cool comparison that you made about James Gunn and Paul Verhoeven. I absolutely see those similarities. I think that's an apt observation. However, when I made the Christopher Nolan quip, that was specifically about superhero films, and just to me, Black Knight or Dark Knight being the ultimate version of a superhero movie that has a awesome script, basically, and that works and is efficient and self-contained and whatnot. I mean, to my knowledge, I don't think Paul Verhoeven ever attempted a superhero movie. I mean, obviously, RoboCop is a movie hero,
pretty close,
you know. But like, I don't think he's based on the comic books, which is really all I meant by the comparison. I do not mean that Christopher Nolan and James Gunn are anyway really alike cinematically and stuff, or stylistically, because you're right, he's way more like a Paul Verhoeven. But I just really meant the quality of these superhero scripts, which I do think you can compare. And I don't think that Suicide Squad, even if I'm gonna compare him to all Paul Verhoeven stuff, I would take any Paul Verhoeven movie over the Suicide Squad any day, in terms of just how competently it's made, but also how engaged in the stories I am of his movies. Fucking Starship Troopers, love the story, love the soap opera dynamic of that weird ass setting and stuff.
Yeah.
RoboCop, amazing story, you know, with an awesome hero's journey and stuff. Total Recall, incredible story. Philip K. Dick, you can thank for that. I just don't get that same like super engagement with the Suicide Squad. I know I'm supposed to care for them. I know I see the setups. I see what he's doing. I'm just kind of going, and maybe this is a personal thing and preference. It's just, it's not as effective for me, which I guess is not a very good, you know, it's just, I'm not showing you the meaning there with that, other than just saying it doesn't work for me as much as Paul Verhoeven's films. But yeah, I don't think the Suicide Squad matches up in terms of a well-written movie.
Y'all know I love some Paul Verhoeven, but I think this voicemail was particularly germane to today's discussion, because this is a movie about small victories in the face of continued systemic white supremacist oppression. Like, this comes back to the hustle and flow thing, where it's like, yeah, he's getting radio play, but he's got to enjoy it from within the walls of this carceral fucking
nightmare.
Well,
because he assaulted somebody, Raymond. he almost killed the man.
I mean, but he pissed on his demo tape. Who's really at fault here?
Okay.
But what I'm saying, Ryan, is that, like, I think one of, like you mentioned before, or maybe it was you, Austin, that I think a lot of the reason for DJ's success, you could argue at the end of the movie, is that he has built this sort of street cred mythology around slapping skinny black. Mm-hmm. Like, that's the kind of thing that could be jet fuel for an aspiring rapper's career.
Of course.
But it is a similar theme to what Newman from Chicago, Ryan's arch nemesis, brought up.
Yeah, and Newman, just because you asked me when I'd be doing another Sam Shepard play, thanks for the shout out. I'd love to do Fool for Love at some point, but we're in the midst of a deep ass lockdown here, so I've just been auditioning for bunches of things, but there's really not much going on in the world of live theater, so, you know, casting directors out there that are listening, fucking hire my shit. Especially because there's a new Netflix show called The Chair that's all about, like, adjunct professors and shit like that. Like, I am an academic and actor. Like, I should be in that fucking movie, okay? Or in that series. Fucking hire my ass for season two, please. Okay. Anyway.
Yes, do it.
Real quick, I'm gonna read one email from Pedro from Brazil, who just says, "Hello, Wisecrack. My name is Pedro. I'm 21 years old and currently studying psychology. I really liked Austin's commentary on the movie being self-aware but not ironically detached, and this summarizes quite well its portrayal of the United States' interference in Latin America. In the beginning of the movie, Waller tells the squad and the audience something in the lines of, the government wasn't friendly, but they were non-antagonistic. But if you're aware of Latin American history with U.S. intervention, we know that this is bullshit. I do agree with Ryan that it's not the first time we see this being tackled, but the way the movie dealt with it was pretty cool in my opinion, especially being from the superhero genre. The images of the jungle gorilla, the tortures that Harley goes through, and the military plot of the movie really evoke those dark times without detracting from the movie's tone or humor or themes." And the last bit that they say is, "On the Peacemaker character, I loved the line, liberty is just an excuse to do whatever you want. He thinks of himself as this man who would do anything for the best interests of the United States, but that's clearly a lie. The character just chooses the violent path without truly thinking about what's best and for which America, people, or institution. When Rick Flagg decides to serve the people by telling the truth, Peacemaker chooses the path that will allow him to keep practicing violence, which is serving the institution. Lots of love from Brazil. See you guys. Thank you, Pedro Fajeda." Any quick thoughts in 20 seconds there? I thought that was a really kind of lovely email, and thank you,
absolutely,
Pedro.
Yeah. I touched on that episode, that I can't remember the name of the island in the Suicide Squad, but it's a very clear allegory. You know, I think we do underestimate the degree to which storytelling does help to prop up American exceptionalism and ultimately American fascism. And so even if it's just lip service, even if it's a small win, I like seeing big movies having a clear-eyed perspective on that sort of thing. So I did appreciate that aspect of it.
I think it's... I have the opposite take, for, like in the sense that, like, I get cynical about when, you know, yeah, this is what, made by Warner Brothers or something, some bazillion-dollar corporation that's essentially like, all right, let's make this fashionable fucking, you know, anti-imperialist statement, when you are, I guess that's a win for James Gunn that he got it through this machine, but also it's like the messenger I don't necessarily trust, so.
I don't know. I mean, these movies are going to get made under any circumstance. You know, if we're going to get treated to 20 superhero movies a year, yeah, I don't mind one of them having at least some kind of, like, you know, progressive sort of political undercurrent.
I'm not necessarily saying I even mind. It's just more like, when I look at their intentions for doing such a thing, I just see a bunch of dollar signs and way less about the fucking, like,
I don't,
like,
know about,
oh, like, which, these are the, my, the, our values as a giant corporation, and we're gonna stick by it. Even if it doesn't make us any money, it's like, no, they said, oh,
I think that's a fairly tenuous argument.
I think it's a cynical argument, but I think that for something
it
like
is that, very cynical. Yeah.
I understand your argument that it may be cynical within the movie, because this is still the product of a huge multinational conglomerate that's being released on HBO or whatever. But at the end of the day, like, if those are the movies that are getting made, at least that's the kind of thing that can serve as a conduit to open people's eyes to the reality that serves as inspiration for those story decisions.
And with that, we're going to put an ellipsis at the end here. You tell us what you think. Is this just some sort of embrace that smothers, or is there something actually progressive that can be told from a big vehicle like Warner Brothers? Email us at movies@wisecrack.co. That's movies@wisecrack.co. Or you can call us and leave us a voicemail, as Newman from Chicago did. Thanks, Newman, for that, by the way. 1-213-534-8807. 1-213-534-8807. Where can people find you on the internet, Raymond?
Yeah, you can find me on Twitter and Letterboxd. I'm at Crematoria. Stop by, say hi.
And Ryan.
Ryan's Game Show on Twitter, Ryan's Shorts. I'm releasing more on Instagram now. I've figured out kids like Instagram, so I'm posting there more.
And TikTok coming soon.
Are you doing a milk crate challenge?
Oh, God, no. Thank you. How do people find Jesus, a 25 milk crates?
Those are brutal.
Yeah.
Yeah, and if you want, you can find me on Twitter, Austin_Hayden, or Insta, AUS_HAY. Do a philosophy podcast called Owls at Dawn. That's me. That's Ryan. That's Raymond. That's Hustle and Flow. We're out. Ryan from Memphis. Send us out, brother.
Goodbye from Hollywood, California. This has been Show Me the Meat.